We start today's program with a look at congressional races. Of Arizona's 9 congressional districts, 3 are considered to have competitive primary races. The first district has 3 Republican candidates vying to take on incumbent Representative Ann Kirkpatrick. The 7th district is going to be an open seat with the retirement of Congressman Ed Pastor. Several candidates are seeking the nomination, but 2 of them are considered to be the frontrunners. And the 9th district features 2 candidates hoping to win the nomination for the chance to face incumbent Congresswoman Kyrsten Sinema. With me to talk about what's going on in those races is Arizona Republic reporter Rebecca Sanders. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start with CD7 on the Democratic side. 4 candidates, but 2, Mary Rose Wilcox, Ruben Gallego, are really fighting it out.
That's right. This is probably the most exciting congressional race we have this year. A real surprise race because no one really expected Congressman Ed Pastor to retire this year, and that has left a really choice seat open because it's so safely Democratic. Whoever wins could probably hold this for another couple of decades. So you can imagine that the stakes are high and the candidates who are running are really pulling out all the stops to win. Our two top leading candidates in this race, as you said, are Mary Rose Wilcox, the former county supervisor, and then Ruben Gallego, a former state lawmaker.
Well, has it gotten nasty? What has stood out about this? Because Mary Rose Wilcox, many politicians have this reputation, but she has a reputation of being willing to really get in there and fight.
Oh, I would say that both of them have that reputation. Some fun fireworks have gone off already several times. Probably the main ones are a real flub by the Mary Rose Wilcox campaign a few weeks back when they essentially tried to get Ruben Gallego kicked off the ballot by questioning whether his last name was legal. In fact, did go and change his name legally some years ago to his mother's name, but because of what appears to be a clerk's error at the court, the paperwork was not findable, and so the Wilcox's campaign assumed that he had not legally corrected his name. So that kind of blew back in their faces. But another of the hot issues has been gun control, and she has really found ways to needle Gallego on his gun control record in terms of some votes that he took in the state legislature that relaxed some rules, and also that he personally owns a gun, took it to the Capitol at one point, and once was a member of the NRA.
What about the generational differences here? That's been fairly stark, this idea that Mary Rose Wilcox has been an elected official for decades. Ruben Gallego has served in the legislature. Are we seeing different people getting behind them based on the generation?
Yeah, this is definitely a big theme in this race. Mary Rose is in her 60s, and she kind of touts herself as experienced with a track record of looking out for the community and for the district and bringing that experience forward and taking care of the legacy of Ed Pastor. Gallego's in his 30s. He's, got fewer years as a politician, and his case is, well, I'm young enough, you send me to Congress, I'll have the time to build seniority and to become a really effective politician, whereas Mayor Rose may leave office sooner than she can actually get results in Washington.
Congressman Pastor is not someone who's usually loud, and we don't hear from him very often. Has he said anything about this race? Has he put his backing behind anyone?
He is fully behind Mary Rose Wilcox, who has been somewhat of a protege of his. She came onto the council after he left for she came on for his county seat. Anyway, they have a long history together, and he is behind her. But it remains to be seen, will that be enough to sway voters to her? I still think that it's a pretty close race.
I want to get to Southern Arizona in a moment, but one more primary election I want to ask you about is District 1, that vast district, which has House Speaker Andy Tobin, also Gary Keeney, and Adam Quastman involved. They're trying to take on Ann Kirkpatrick. That's been kind of an interesting race, too. There's been a lot of sniping in that one, hasn't there?
Yeah, there's been a lot of ups and downs. Last year, it seemed that everyone pretty conclusively thought that Andy Tobin being you know, head of the state House of Representatives was going to kind of be a shoo-in in this district. But he kind of sputtered. And part of it is probably because he was so busy at the legislature, he couldn't focus completely on the campaign. But also he's just more of an establishment figure. And there's still this strain of Republican primary voters that wants more of a Tea Party candidate, which Keeney and Quasman are kind of trying to appeal to.
Is Quasman going to be hurt by that controversy, that confusion in Oracle where he misidentified the bus carrying undocumented minors?
I mean, this certainly was an embarrassing moment for him. He's, as a young freshman lawmaker, that he would, you know, make a big deal about these migrant children, pointing out that he saw the fear in their faces on the bus, and it turned out to be YMCA campers.
Summer camp can be scary.
This can be. This went national. But, you know, it seems to me that it's such a kind of a fluke thing, and that, you know, diehard conservative voters probably are going to look past it and look more to his record and what he's saying ideologically that appeals to them.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Rebecca Sanders, reporter for the Arizona Republic, about some of Arizona's congressional races. So let's go to Southern Arizona, the 2nd District. Ron Barber's had an interesting run there, finishing the term of Gabrielle Giffords and then being elected on his own. It seems like that's pretty much, we know it's going to be a one-on-one battle. We know he's going to have a rematch. And tell us about his opponent.
Yeah, his opponent likely is Martha McSally. She ran against him last time and came very close to winning. She's a retired Air Force pilot, was the first female airman in combat. She has a very compelling personal story, a likable personality, and she's been essentially gearing up for this for 2 years now. And pretty much every Republican in the country who cares about winning seats is behind her. So she definitely has a lot of firepower. And to equal it, Democrats are really gearing up to defend Ron this fall as well. So this is going to be probably the most blowout money campaign we'll see this cycle. But definitely Ron is, Congressman Barber is one of the most vulnerable Democrats in the country right now. It's going to be quite a match.
Have you heard anything about former Representative Giffords or her husband Mark Kelly coming to Southern Arizona to campaign for him?
It's, I don't know specifics, but it is very likely that they'll have a strong role. And indeed that some of the gun control groups that she and others work on will probably come in to support him, as well as lots of other outside groups.
As you said, a lot of money coming in, expected to come in. Is that considered to be a swing district? I think people have this perspective on Southern Arizona leaning more to the left.
This is actually quite a toss-up district, almost nearly half Republican, half Democrat, because it also includes not only Tucson, which leans left generally, but also all of Cochise County, which is right along the border, includes a lot of kind of the conservative rancher communities.
One other district we haven't talked about yet is the 9th, which was also considered to be sort of a toss-up a couple of years ago because it was the new district. It was also considered to be fairly evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats. Now, Kyrsten Sinema, even after just one term, seems to have cemented herself in the sense that her opponents, potential opponent in the Republican primary, your newspaper, I know you're not involved in editorial decisions, didn't even endorse one of the candidates. Tell us about Andrew Walter and Wendy Rogers.
Right. So this district is basically right where we are, all of Tempe, much of Phoenix, some parts of the East Valley. And it is technically a swing district, but Sinema seems to have done a good job as a freshman, really having a fairly moderate voting record. Her constituent services apparently have done a good job reaching out to the community, as have the other swing Democrats. But it seems like the demographics here in Tempe and Phoenix just favor her a lot more, and that she hasn't attracted a strong enough Republican challenger to really go against her. Andrew Walters, former ASU quarterback, NFL quarterback, also in the finance industry, you know, that profile looked really attractive at first, but he's not really been able to gain momentum. Wendy Rogers has higher name ID. She's run in this district a couple of times, but she's a little bit abrasive and, you know, seems to not strike a lot of the maybe independent voters the right way. And it seems clear from the way the money is flowing, pretty much no Republican group is taking part in this race because it just doesn't look that winnable.
Well, that's going to be my final question for you. Usually conventional wisdom is you want to get that candidate as early in his or her career as possible, because then once they get cemented, it's hard to defeat them. So does this indicate to you that Sinema is pretty much a powerhouse as far as Republicans are concerned?
That seems to be the prevailing wisdom. And yeah, if they couldn't knock her out last time, this was going to be their second best chance. Once this election is over, you know, she's got that incumbent power that just probably will keep her there until she wants to perhaps run for higher office. But, you know, again, it is considered a swing district, and there are so few in the country. It's actually amazing Arizona has three. We could see Republicans turning around in the fall and saying, well, we should really put up a good fight here.
Rebecca Sanders of the Arizona Republic. You can follow her on Twitter at Rebecca L. Sanders. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out whether Andrew Thomas really has a chance to win the GOP gubernatorial primary, and we'll introduce you to an African fellow who is at ASU for the past 6 weeks. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by SRP Community Solar, offering customers a way to get solar energy without rooftop panels. More information about this program at srpcommunitysolar.com.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. Checking temperatures around the state right now, it's 77 degrees in Flagstaff, mostly sunny and 88 in Prescott, sunny and 100 degrees in Casa Grande, it's 97 in Tucson, and the state's hotspot right now is Yuma, where under mostly sunny skies, it's 108 degrees. Checking valley traffic on the surface streets, we're seeing a report of an accident at 40th Street and Thomas. Stay with us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for BBC NewsHour. It's 104 degrees right now in Phoenix. It's 11:20 at KJZZ.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Recent polls suggest that a lot of people who will end up voting in Arizona's Republican gubernatorial primary haven't made up their minds about who will receive that vote. Ken Bennett, Doug Ducey, Christine Jones, and Scott Smith all seem to be within a few points of each other. But with a total of six candidates in the field, the winner may emerge with little more than 20% of the vote. Some analysts have speculated about whether that means Andrew Thomas could make history by becoming a disbarred former county attorney running with public money who somehow pulled a huge upset. In a few minutes, historian Jack August will help us put that into perspective. First, though, I turn to Greg Patterson of EspressoPundit.com, who recently wrote about why candidates and the media shouldn't sleep on Thomas.
He's the only one who is not an establishment conservative. I think you can point to all four of the main contenders and say that they are conservatives, but they're very much establishment conservatives. They're either business, high-ranking CEO types, or they're political types, or in Smith's case, he's both. And because of that, they're towing a very narrow establishment conservative line. For example, on Senate Bill 1062, they all said they would have vetoed it, and yet it's very similar to the Hobby Lobby decision, for example. And so there's a big chunk of the electorate that's not going to be real happy with that.
Center for Arizona Policy is usually very out front as far as what the conservative viewpoint is in Arizona, at least the Valley.
Right.
And there was a little bit of a clash there with Kathy Herod and Doug Ducey when Ducey talked about 1062 at
right.
the time. Organizations like that, how big a role will they play in the primary?
I think organizations like that, and I know Kathy very well, would be very hesitant to endorse Andy Thomas. I don't see that. So the kind of establishment social conservatives will still avoid him. But there are a lot of people out there who are, I think, frankly, very upset about the way, for example, gay marriage has been handled. It is not an issue, apparently, where reasonable people can disagree. Barack Obama opposed gay marriage as late as 08, so did Hillary Clinton. And now there are folks who are targeting people who have supported it in the past. And so I think they've made a lot of progress, much of it by winning hearts and minds, but Phil Boas of the Arizona Republic wrote an article about how frightening that group can be. And so I think a lot of it is won through intimidation. And I think when Thomas stands up and says that he will, quote, fight the gay lobby or stand up to the homosexual lobby, I think that will resonate with a lot of people who aren't necessarily willing to admit it.
So is this something, if Thomas plays this correctly, he'll get enough of that core group to say, I'm with you on this?
I think there is still a strong social conservative non-establishment segment of the electorate, and he is the only one who's directly appealing to that group. And this is going to be a really split vote. You have four very credible people, and then Frank Riggs will get a little bit, and Thomas can win this with 22%, 21%. And if he's the one who really stands up and says, I'm going to secure the border and I'm going to, in his words, stand up to the homosexual lobby, that is something that will resonate with a good chunk of the Republican electorate.
I think a lot of listeners are going to be shocked by that.
Yeah.
Only because they...
Because this is KJS.
But I think people are going to think to themselves, all right, here's someone who, whether his defenders say it was not fair or not,
right,
disbarred county attorney, going after judges... He even lost a lot of supporters because of that, because people are like, okay, maybe go against the supervisors, but not the judges. Where is he right now?
I wrote a piece against him, you know, in the 2010 race that it was titled Unfit to Serve. So, I mean, you know, he's certainly not going to count me as a fan. I do think his judgment in the county issue was just phenomenally bad. And I think he was properly disbarred for that. However, I think that his supporters are going to say he stood up to the liberal judges and the liberal judges disbarred him. And that's a badge of honor for him. That's like a civil rights activist. They say, oh, yeah, he was in jail. Well, yeah, he was in jail. He does the things he's supposed to do, and they jailed him. And Thomas is going to say to his supporters, I stood up against the liberal judges and they disbarred me. So I think that his background does not hurt him. Let me add one piece that's the dirty tricks department, which is that the Democratic Party in Arizona has sent out pieces in support of libertarian candidates saying he's the true conservative who supports Second Amendment rights and will repeal Obamacare. And that goes to Republicans in an effort to pull votes from conservative Republicans towards libertarians. That's a common tactic now, and the Democratic Party in Arizona has done that. And nationally, the Democratic Party and independent supporters have supported the weakest Republican or the most extreme Republican in any field in hopes that they can get the person they want to run against. So I would not be surprised to see pieces talking about Andy Thomas as the real conservative, Andy Thomas who's against Obamacare, Andy Thomas who stands up to the homosexual lobby, Andy Thomas who will do whatever. And that comes from mysterious dark money that actually comes from the left.
But our independent voters, a lot of people are banking on them sort of flipping the tide the other way, or maybe they give Scott Smith or Ken Bennett more votes than they would have expected. So is that sort of one working against the other?
There's two brands of independents. There's independents who are essentially going to be weak party identifying Democrats, some of whom will do that little dirty trick of they can vote in the primary anyway. They don't necessarily like the guys on the right, and they may just decide to vote for Thomas either as a protest vote or as a disruptive vote. So you've got that with the independents. And then the rest of the independents, I think, kind of split throughout. And independents have a tendency not to vote. And so this is one that could really be manipulated by the process, especially since nobody is really going after that hard right social conservative, the non-establishment social conservative voter.
Is Andrew Thomas the only one who would be considered to be an underdog to Fred Duvall?
Well, if Frank Riggs wins, he'd be an underdog to Fred Duvall. Sure, Andy Thomas would be, because there's a significant part of the Republican establishment who absolutely would not vote for him. And I think the media would just completely jump on him and say that he is an absolute pariah. However, I don't think Fred Duvall would be a lock to go against him. I think if Democrats decide that they're going to push Andy Thomas in an effort to give Fred Duvall the best shot, that's a really risky maneuver, because you could end up with Governor Thomas.
How significant, if at all, is Governor Brewer's endorsement if she decides to throw one out there?
I think it certainly has an effect. However, if you're running as a non-establishment candidate, then you can point at her support of an establishment candidate and say, oh, that's just an example of how they all work together. And so that could actually be to Thomas's advantage eventually.
Chances of Thomas winning, do you think it's... Does he have a 1% chance to? Does he have more than that?
He has more than that. The beauty of gambling on elections is, or like horse races, right, is that long shots pay more. So, you know, you would want to gamble on, you know, Ducey and Jones. But if you wanted to put a lot of money on that, you'd probably lose. But if you won, you'd won big. You put that on Thomas, absolutely, because he has to pay 5 or 6 to 1. And I think the odds of him winning are better than 5 or 6 to 1. So I think it's possible.
Greg Patterson, you can read his commentary online at espressopundit.com. Greg, thanks.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I had a confirming, should I say, spirit when I got into this race that I'd win it. I have felt all the time that I would. And the prayers of just tens of thousands of people across this state have been with us. This has been a campaign for the people, and that's what's won it. We've finally got our message out to the people. And I've always said that my thinking was in the mainstream of Arizona.
That was Evan Meekham on the night he recorded one of the bigger upsets in Arizona political history, defeating legislative powerhouse Burton Barr in the Republican primary. Then Meekham went on to an even bigger upset when he won the general election. With me to provide some perspective is historian Jack August, who's written biographies of Carl Hayden and Raul Castro, among others. He's also the visiting scholar in legal history at Snell and Wilmer. Hi, Jack.
Hey, hi, Steve.
So, Evan Meekham, put this in perspective for us. A lot of people who've heard his name only think about when he defeated Burton Barr and then won the general election, but he'd been around many years before that.
Yes, he had an earlier run-through with all of this. He was, I don't know if people remember, you'd have to be pretty elderly to remember that when he was a state senator in 1960, before the one-man vote, one-vote rule, and then he wanted to jump into the big time. And so in 1962, just out of nowhere, he decided he wanted to become the U.S. senator, that Senator Carl Hayden had moved too far to the left. Hayden was 82 years old, so there was the age issue and all of that. But the Republicans, on the other hand, the establishment Republicans, if I can use that term, had figured out that Steve Shadegg, Congressman John Shadegg's father, who had previously been Senator Goldwater's campaign manager and a political operative and kind of a political technician, a great, a big brain, as it were. He was supposed to be the nominee, but then out of nowhere, this maverick, 38 years old, crew cut, comes from the state legislature and runs. And I recall doing the research on Senator Hayden that Roy Elson, his chief aide and confidant, said, you know, we were really worried about that guy in the general. And he says that there was something we thought he could do. They ran a vigorous campaign. He had a group of women that went around called the Meekhamettes. And he worked it hard. And he worked the grassroots hard. Did the coffees on TV, as did Steve Shadegg. And also, I think he did something that may have played into the 1986 rerun of a statewide primary campaign. And that is, I think, that he had some institutional support that was broad and deep in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And when pollsters would call and say, who are you going to vote for, let's say, they either didn't answer or they gave a misleading answer. And so it appeared as though Shadegg was going to win, but when primary election day came in 1962, Ev Meekham won the primary, and so that's the first Evan Meekham shock in Arizona's political history.
Well, so then nearly 25 years later, even after losing that race in 62, are you saying maybe the same kind of thing happened where people were asked about it and Burton Barr thought he was a shoo-in, but he really wasn't?
Yeah, I think that happened. He also did mass mailings of, like, newspapers. And when I interviewed Senator Meekham Governor Meekham prior to his passing, he viewed himself. I said, "What's your what do you do for a living?" He goes, "I'm a publisher." He always viewed himself as a journalist, just as you had on just prior
wow,
to this.
Really?
And so, yeah, and he published the Evening American and all that. And in 62, when I interviewed Ev about that race and Roy Elson, we actually had a session at the Arizona Historical Convention one year together, Roy Elson, Evan Meekham, and myself. He said, man, if I only had two more weeks, I could feel it, we could win. But, the election wasn't in December, it was in November. But he came closer. And in fact, in Carl Hayden's long political history, Meekham came closer than anyone to defeating him in a Senate race. So, and so we go to 1986, and I read Mr. McCachern's piece this morning about Meekham and Thomas, the comparison. And he was right about one thing, is that we had a lot of people that didn't know voting at that time that Ev had run continuously and had become kind of a one-trick pony over several elections. But by that time, and with the sudden population growth and economic growth in the 1980s, people didn't know this guy. And he won that surprising primary, and then with 39.6% of the vote wins the election. But what he did, and I've heard this from a couple sources, I can't footnote it yet, but I did hear that he employed the same notion of having his followers, which again, broad and deep and part of Arizona's political and religious culture, that they either didn't answer the polls, and so it looked as though, kind of like Eric Cantor did, that he was way up in the polls, but there was this groundswell of support and this very deeply rooted a group of true believers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened there. And I think Burton Barr was shocked. Maybe on the other side, he may not have worked as hard, felt as though he was entitled to the position. I don't really know about the Barr situation. I know there's a book coming out on him, and so I'll be interesting to read on Burton Barr, by the way. But and so that's what happened in 86, and then the general was a once in a lifetime kind of
right.
Thing.
It was a 3-person race, which we can't really have again because the laws have changed. But that was a case where the two Democrats fought it out, and one Democrat, Bill Shultz, decided to run
as an independent.
And
had to do with his daughter. And I interviewed Bill, and it's like during the last 22 days of the campaign, I think, or a couple months, they appeared, all three of them together every night, and they became kind of this weird family where Carolyn Warner, the Democratic candidate, would fix Governor Meekham's wig before they went on, and they became strangely friendly, and Shultz told me in an extraordinary gesture that after the last Sunday night before the Tuesday election, their cars were parked out somewhere in Sun City, and they were parked right next to each other, and they hugged each other, and somehow a unique, if not bizarre, friendship was forged during that period. So at least one person has given that history to me.
But it's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with historian Jack August. We have a few minutes left in our conversation. We're sort of comparing Andrew Thomas with Ev Meekham. So let me come back to the current time, Jack. From what you've heard, from what you've read, are there parallels to you between Thomas and Meekham?
I think a thin veneer of a parallel, but I think there's the political calculus is quite different today. Can it happen? Perhaps. Will it happen? I don't think so. But again, I'm a historian. I'm not as smart as these political pundits and can foretell the future. But anyway, anything can happen. He's playing to a very conservative base, and they do vote.
Well, you did mention true believers, and I think that's one of the parallels that people want to see, this idea that there are people who really feel like Thomas, whether they're right or wrong, feel like he was railroaded when he was disbarred. And so that's made them really dig in their heels, and they're going to vote for him regardless. Is there a feeling that maybe some of the other candidates don't have the loyalty to that degree?
I think you're right. I think there's a core constituency. I don't know if it's going to rain the night of the, like it did in 86, and have low turnout. I don't know if this is going to be a low turnout election or not. Those are all the kind of factors that need that people should speculate about if they're really interested in this race. I am. I think it's really fascinating. And there seems to be, with the other candidates, there seems to be some fluidity. And and movement. I don't know if it's due to the negative attack ads, the dark money ads, or whatever, but you know, my hat's off to anyone that gets into the arena and goes through this kind of torture.
Jack, final question for you then.
Yeah.
If somehow Andrew Thomas were to win the Republican primary, where would you rank that in terms of an upset compared to what Meekum did?
Boy, it's right there. It may be from sitting here right now across from you, I would say it would be even a bigger upset. I would rank that number one and the Meekum upset number two. And we ought to do an article on political upsets in Arizona history. But that's for another day.
Jack August, who's written biographies of Carl Hayden and Raul Castro, Dennis DeConcini, among others. He's also the visiting scholar in legal history at Snell and Wilmer. Jack, thanks as always.
Hey, thanks, Steve.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll meet an African fellow who's been at Arizona State University for the past 6 weeks or so, and we'll hear about a new play by Ben Tyler. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Live Nation, presenting blues performer B.B. King returning to Comerica Theater Saturday, September 27th for a night of blues to remember. Tickets on sale now and available online at Ticketmaster.com.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. We have an excessive heat warning in effect and an ozone health watch for the valley until 8 o'clock tonight. It'll be mostly sunny, dry, and hot in Phoenix, with a high near 112 degrees. Stay with us at 12 o'clock. We'll have NPR's Here and Now. Retirement is a part of the American dream, but some seniors are moving into RVs, traveling the country looking for work. That's Here and Now from Boston, coming up at noon on KJZZ. Sunny skies, and it's 104 degrees in Phoenix. It's 11:39.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix.
Having spoken to most of the fellows after I came here, I was aware that we all had some foreboding coming here. We all had anxiety. I am standing here specifically to thank Arizonans for their warm welcome, for being responsive for our needs, for showing us the true color of the state, and for proving to us that the dryness of your ground in no way reflects the generosity and the love of your hearts.
That's Al Kaggs, one of the Mandela Washington Fellows, who spent the past 6 weeks or so at ASU. He's with me from Washington, D.C., and here in studio at KJZZ is Jonathan Capel, Dean of the College of Public Programs at Arizona State. Jonathan, tell us what this program was about, how many people applied, and so forth.
Arizona State is one of 20 American universities hosting delegations of Washington Fellows. The Washington Fellows are 500 young African leaders who were chosen from a mind-bogglingly large pool of 50,000 applicants who are participating in this inaugural program to bring the most dynamic, promising young African leaders to the United States, to give them access to some training that might help them be more successful, and also to provide them the opportunity to network with each other as a means of building their capacity to affect change in Africa.
You know, perception is an interesting thing. How little does the average Arizonan, how little does the average American know about Africa? What do you think they know about it, and what should they know about it?
I think that the media presents a very skewed view of Africa. So the average American, if they see coverage of Africa, they see war, they see poverty, and they see disease. And that seems to be the sum total of Africa. What they don't see is an incredibly vibrant economy. What they don't see is the youngest population in the world that is focused on improving circumstances, starting businesses. They don't see any of that. So what they think Africa is a charity case, and that's completely backwards. And this has been a great program because it introduces Americans to the real Africa.
I actually think that there's a more significant issue with regard to how Americans view Africa, and that is that they view it as one country. So you find that in a lot of programs, you will see programs Describing countries. Somebody is talking about a program of where they work. They say, we work in Brazil, Honduras, England, China, and Africa. And so essentially what they do is that they assume that Africa is one country rather than 54 countries that are very different, that have very different dynamics and that sort of thing.
And there's such a different dynamic even between sub-Saharan Africa as well, right?
Exactly. So if you go into sub-Saharan Africa, you have 49 countries that are also very, very, very different. If you go to Nigeria, for example, the people, the cultures, the economy, the politics is not the same as it is in Tanzania, for example. Africa has been the victim, I think, for a long time of, and this is, I think, thanks to media and policymakers, of grand generalization. And I think one of the things that this Washington Fellowship has been valuable in achieving has been to enable for Americans and for Arizonans to know that Africa is not one big country.
Al, knowing that was the perspective generally, at least the, again, the perception, how excited or not excited were you to find out you were coming to Arizona?
Personally, I wasn't. I even, to be honest, protested. I was told that I was coming to Arizona, and my perception of Arizona was that it was hot and that it was a desert. I didn't know anything about the greener sides of Arizona. I had been to Arizona before, but I didn't even know that time that the Grand Canyon was in Arizona, even though that I had been there. I felt that it was in a different state because we drove a long, long time to get there, and nobody really explained it to me.
But in a deeper sense, there had also been, there's been the reputation of Arizona because of certain bills that some people see Arizona not being friendly toward immigrants. Was that something you were concerned about?
So initially, I didn't even know about that. I just protested about being sent to the desert. And then when they told me that I cannot change the decision, I must come to Arizona, I then started reading about it. And then I saw these bills. And when I saw these bills, I was in shock. I said, but, you know, this doesn't seem right. And I worried a little bit about what kind of reception I would have when I arrived in Arizona. The experience that I've had over the past 6 weeks has been, to say the least, surprising and really heartwarming because of the fact that, you know, Jonathan and his team, first of all, were very prepared for us, and they were also prepared for our misconceptions, so for our perceptions. And they were very warm, and they sort of anticipated our needs in very interesting ways, including some of the discomforts that anyone would have when they go to a different place. Burgers are great for the first 2 days, but we don't eat fast food in Kenya like Americans do. We eat what you call organic food, and Arizona State University was able to accommodate that need for us. We don't do iced tea. We don't understand iced tea. When tea is cold in Africa, we throw it out. here we see people putting ice in tea, and it completely confused us. When Arizona State University learned about that, they sort of stopped offering us iced tea and offered us lemonade instead, which was much more pleasant. So it is these little things that that helped a great deal. But speaking of perceptions, by the way, mm-hmm. we also had perceptions of America that are fed by the media, that it is this land that has no problem. Mm-hmm. We came with perception that America is a place that where green dollar bills grow on trees. Everybody has a lot of money, and nobody has a real problem, and you have first world problems. I'm sure you're familiar with the term.
Sure.
Where, you know, your biggest problem is whether to get an iPhone or to get an iPad sort of thing.
Well, do you think that reality then, Al, is that reality something that makes it so this program is even more effective because the problems are more understandable? We're more on an even keel than people may have anticipated.
Yeah, you know, when you think of someone as being so much more advanced than you or not having the same problems as you and stuff like that, you sort of are unable to really respond to them as an equal. You are unable to engage with them as an equal, and instead what you do is you sort of subjugate yourself, even without them subjugating you. And our realization that, you know, America is struggling with a lot of the same problems that we have been struggling with in our country helped a great deal, because of the fact that especially it helped us to, it just gives me better strength to be able to respond to other people that I speak to.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Al Kaggs and Jonathan Capel. Jonathan, let me bring you back into the conversation. We've talked a lot about what Al and maybe the other fellows have learned. What did you learn from them?
Well, one of the things that Al said is an observation that I had as well, but in a slightly different way, which is we probably didn't sufficiently take advantage of the opportunity to learn from the fellows and the things that they've been able to accomplish. And so this is hopefully a program that's not going away. Indeed, President Obama, when he welcomed the fellows to Washington, announced, first of all, that it was named in honor of Nelson Mandela going forward, and that the aspiration is to double it in size. My hope is that in the years ahead, we will create more opportunities for not only people in Arizona, but obviously everybody who's hosting the fellows, to get the benefit of the wisdom that's brought by the fellows. So these are people who have started businesses in very difficult circumstances, who have founded nonprofit organizations to advocate for the rights of the disabled, or to bring education to women, or to better preserve natural resources, or to expand opportunities for poor to have education. We can learn a lot from what they've been able to do with very little resources.
Al, we know that one of the major programs you want to be involved in is improving education in sub-Saharan Africa. I wonder if you'd give us some background on what are the biggest obstacles toward better education in sub-Saharan Africa, and how do you want to go about changing that?
I think the biggest problem is lack of evidence in terms of, so policymakers are having these conversations. And I'll tell you, I mean, literally today at 4 a.m. this morning, I was attending online a meeting that was happening in East Africa that was specifically discussing education. And it sort of, the experience underlined exactly what the problem is. There's a lot of conversation about the education sector, but there's not enough evidence that is helping people to know how to think about the problem or to articulate the problem better. So there's a lot of solutions being offered that sometimes are not quite congruent to the problem. So, for example, somebody says, oh, you know, there are lots of children who walk 7 kilometers to go to school, so we should feed them. The problem isn't that the children do not have food. The problem is that they have to walk 7 kilometers to go to school, and therefore the solution should be to put a school near them so that they don't have to walk 7 kilometers to school, sort of thing. When you discover that these are some of the issues that are there, one of the things that we want to do is that we have a project that was founded, actually, at the Arizona State University by 7 fellows. And what we want to do is we want to provide an evidence base for policymakers to be able to properly talk about the question of education and to be able to identify truly what the challenges are.
That's Al Kaggs, one of the Mandela Washington Fellows who spent the past 6 weeks or so at Arizona State University. I was also joined by Jonathan Capel, Dean of the College of Public Programs at ASU. As we mentioned, Al Kaggs will be working to improve education in his home community in Kenya. And here in town, KJZZ is launching a new series to explore different ideas about community in Phoenix. As your community news station, we hope you'll join us on air and online over the coming months and learn along with us. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Many of the most popular and most highly regarded plays are personal and come from the deepest parts of our hearts and souls. Veteran Valley playwright Ben Tyler has impacted the theater scene here for decades with productions like Gov, Mr. Conservative, and a trilogy about Wallace and Ladmo. But it wasn't until his newest, The Sperm of 10 Men, that Tyler really opened up about his own experience.
No matter how you say that title, it always comes out odd-sounding. This is the first thing I've ever written for myself, about myself, and it's special to me for that reason.
And you decided to dive right in. Not my. I bought a new suit. It's The Sperm of 10 Men. So, You want to go
as personal
as possible.
Well, this is, it's been hard for this to leave my mind. My brother is a sculptor, and he made a statue for me that I use in the show, and it is actually a steel sperm. And it sits in my office at home, and I see it daily, and it has constantly been reminding me that there is a story there. So I decided to finally put pen to paper and bring this to the stage.
Now, I may have buried the lead on this, so give us the background on the story and how the title fits in so well.
When my brother was quite young, in his mid-20s, he decided to have a vasectomy, and he had to go to several different doctors before he found one that would do it, because they all said, no, you're going to change your mind. Well, he finally had it done, and then sure enough, he changed his mind. So when I was in my early 30s, he asked me if I would be willing to be a sperm donor for he and his wife. And that's where the whole notion of sperm and everything comes into this. So the story is basically my adventures as a sperm donor, and I don't think that many people have considered what it's like from the male perspective. You know, we always think of the miracle of modern science, and isn't it great how, you know, women can, or couples can have babies, or even single women can have babies in a non-traditional way. And so this is, you know, the story of what it's like to be on the other end of things.
What's your approach, man? Because you've obviously done a lot of humorous stuff. You've done some serious stuff. Do you try to balance it? Does it feel realistic, or is it a little absurd?
Well, it is absurd. I had no idea what I was committing myself to. And, you know, this, there's always something more. In a good play, I think there's always something more than just the surface story. And really what this is about to me is the permanence or the impermanence of things in life. My brother and I are both artists. I work in theater, and he is a sculptor. And the lifespan of things, for example, a play, is a rather short lifespan as opposed to a steel statue that has a rather long lifespan. And this has been a source of conversation for my brother and I for some time about the temporary nature of theater as opposed to the longer lifespan of something like sculpting. And so it really does have to do with something more than just being a sperm donor. To me, that if I was to describe this in just a word or two, it would be about the permanence of things, or, as I said, the impermanence of things.
Without giving away too much, what's are you an uncle?
I am. I'm an uncle quite a few times over.
Okay.
But I don't. You're right. I don't want to give a spoiler here on the, how this play ends, because I think it is a surprise, and I'd like it to be a surprise for the audience.
As someone who's been writing for as long as you have and has had ideas brewing of all sorts, was this one that you fully intended to make art out of, or no?
Well, when I was going through the process, no, that never dawned on me. My brother made the statue for me as a way of saying thank you for the effort that I was putting in for him and his wife. It was like many things, when it happens, when it's behind you, then you can look back at it, and I thought, wow, you know, this is really an interesting story. And I had never done a one-man show before, and it just seemed like a really interesting way to deal with it. And so it explores the, you know, the idea of being a sperm donor, but also it has a lot to do with art, the notion of art. My feeling about theater is that, yes, it may have a short lifespan, but if it's a good play, it lives on in your mind, and it will live on in your mind as long as you're around, and that's permanent for anybody, your lifespan, that's your conscious period of time. So in a way, I think that it is permanent.
You mentioned that you've only performed this once in front of an audience, right, in Cottonwood. How did you feel? First time as a one-man show, first time being this personal. Are you any more nervous, even as though you've been a performer for decades?
Well, you know what? If you're not nervous, something's wrong. I've been doing this for quite some time as an actor as well as a writer. And if you're not nervous, well, you should be the first few times that you do something new. And I got to tell you, that first time that I did it up in Cottonwood, I was very nervous because my brother was in the audience, and so was my sister and my sister-in-law and a lot of my family members who knew this story up close and personal. I had let them look at it ahead of time But anytime you're writing, someone is writing about you and going to perform something in front of an audience, in the interest of keeping my family together, I let them take a look at it first. But yeah, that was kind of a little nerve-wracking doing it in front of my whole family there.
Because of what happened last week, the passing of an icon here, an icon to whom you had a pretty deep connection, I can't let you go without asking you about Bill Wallace Thompson. How significant is he in the pop culture scene and the history of the last 50 years of the Valley?
Hugely important, and hugely important to me. My very first memories and recollections of having anything to do with watching television was all about Wallace and Ladmo. And the thing that I think a lot of people don't remember, those of us who are of a certain age that grew up watching it, we had rather limited choices back then. There was Channel 3, 5, 10, 12, and something called Channel 8 that was really boring and nobody ever watched. It was a shared experience for that reason. Everyone I knew came home after school and watched that program. So Wallace's sense of humor permeated everyone that I knew, and it was, for those who don't know it, it was in many ways the anti-kid show. It was so unique, so irreverent, you couldn't do a kid show like that today. So it had a huge impact on my sense of humor, my sense of writing. And then when I grew up, I was really lucky enough to spend a couple of years working for the Wallace and Ladmo show as a writer. And I had to pinch myself to make sure that I really realized that this was happening. I couldn't believe that I had grown up and been able to work for them. He was, to say he was one of a kind is an understatement. He just was the most unique individual I've ever met. Humble, generous, funny as hell, and just a great guy to know. And it was really a gift that we had him here, and I just feel now a tremendous sense of loss. You know, they were like characters. You don't expect a character to die. I felt the same way when Ladmo passed on. They were bigger than life, and you expect them to live on forever. But, of course, that's not the case. Once again, coming back to that permanence thing, nothing does last forever. But, boy, he sure gave a lot and had a huge impact on, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, hundreds of thousands of people.
Actor and playwright Ben Tyler, his new one-man show, The Sperm of 10 Men, is being performed tonight at 7 at the Black Theater Troupe Center for the Performing Arts near 13th Street and Washington in Phoenix. It's part of a two-play combo. The other is Dodging Bullets by David Barker. That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on the program. And thanks very much to you for listening. If you missed a segment or want to catch up with one of our previous programs, go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org. Now it's time for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.